Members, I call this meeting of State Government Finance and Elections Committee to order for Wednesday, March 10th, 2021. And pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting is being held virtually. The committee aide, legislative assistant, will take the call, roll call.
Chair Nelson?
I'm here.
Vice Chair Carlson? Representative Nash?
Present.
Representative Bonner?
Present.
Representative Drazkowski?
Here.
Representative Elkins?
Present.
Representative Greenman?
Present.
Representative Cleburne?
Present.
Representative Kosnick? Representative Mason?
Present.
Representative New Brindley?
Present.
Representative Pulaski? Representative Quam?
Present.
A quorum is present.
And I see Representative Carlson has joined us now, too.
Carlson, present.
Excellent.
All members, next on the agenda is the approval of the minutes. Representative Carlson, you get a chance to look at the minutes from yesterday's meeting?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to approve the minutes from March 9th.
Representative Carlson moves the approval of the minutes for March 9th. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Ayes have it. And I see Representative Pulaski's joined us now also. Members, first off, we ran out of time yesterday in House File 585, and I'm going to move to reconsider House File 1585. And members, this is a voice vote. I move to reconsider the motion that was done on the at the end of the day. Members, all in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. Members, with that, House File 1585, make sure I say the number right, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. There's fiscal pieces here that deal with, we have to deal with. So with that, members, the first bill on our agenda for today, the new bill, is House File 702, Representative Becker Finn and Representative Mason. Can you, do you want to move the local government division report? You're muted.
I so move.
Representative Mason moves the local government division report for House File 702. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? With that, I'll move that I'll move House File 702 to go to the general register. Welcome to the committee, Representative Becker Finn, and you're muted also, so you can start explaining your bill. And I see there's an A1 amendment. Do you want us to do that first?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
With that, I'll move the A1 amendment to House File 702. All in favor of the A1 author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? You got the bill the way you want it, Representative Becker Finn. Please describe your bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 702 allows municipalities to issue licenses to hotels. On its face, you may make some assumptions about the purpose of this bill, but the real reason for this bill is to create another tool for cities to control properties that are located in their cities where there may be criminal activity happening. And the current tools that we have not been effective at being able to stop those activities from happening, particularly when you have sort of a bad apple situation with an owner of a hotel property who may be not cooperating with local law enforcement or even encouraging that type of activity to occur on their property. So that is House File 702. For those who were here for the local government hearing, we have made a couple changes. Subsection D has been removed. There was some language about public health boards, and House Research had put that in initially, and after some discussion, it wasn't necessary to get this done. And then we also added a limit on the fee that a city can charge for this license. Of course, not the purpose of why I'm bringing this forward, but there was some concern about what other cities may do with this tool. And so we wanted to make sure that this isn't a money-making enterprise here. It's a tool for local cities. And so with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers, and they can explain specifically why the city of Roseville is seeking this.
And the first person I have testifier is Joe Adams, Roseville Police Department Deputy Chief. Mr. Chief Adams, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good evening. Joe Adams, Deputy Police Chief with the City of Roseville. First, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to speak today about this important topic. The Roseville Police Department is very much in support of this hotel licensing bill. Over the past few years, the Roseville Police Department has seen an increase in crime and public safety concerns at our hotels, specifically at three of them. The crimes include human trafficking, robberies, shooting, and sexual assaults. We have tried to work with the problem hotel's management and owners, but they have refused to address the increasing crime and police calls to their hotels. We've asked them to sit down and speak with us, and they've also refused to do that. The increase in crime and public safety concerns have impacted not only the guests staying at the hotels, but also the businesses and residents in the area around the hotels. One daycare center reported their staff and parents no longer felt safe based on the foot traffic coming and going from one of the three problem hotels. Recently, a corporate group staying at a different upscale Roseville hotel said they were considering canceling their contract, not because of the activity at the hotel they were staying at, but because of the ongoing criminal activity their staff observed at one of the nearby problem property hotels. A few statistics to share with you. In Roseville, we have a total of 12 hotels. In the past 3 years, of those 12 hotels, the problem three have received 74% of our calls. In the past 3 years, we have responded to a total of 21 fights at the Roseville hotels. Of those, 17 of the 21 were at the three problem hotels. For weapon-related calls, 13 of the 16 were at our three problem hotels. We have had 14 robberies reported at the hotels, with 13 of the 14 occurring at one of our three problem hotels. Although the stats are certainly troublesome, it's the victims and those being trafficked out of the hotels that is of most concern. I have three quick stories to share with you. In 2017, Victor Lynch was charged with third-degree murder in the death of a 28-year-old female. Lynch had mixed and administered a lethal dose of methamphetamine and heroin at one of our problem hotels. He then took steps to cover up the death. Lynch had an extensive criminal history, including a history of serious drug offenses. And of most concern, Lynch not only lived at the hotel, but he was the only on-site maintenance worker. Last month, Roseville officers assisting with inspectors learned from one of the maintenance workers that in December, there had been a shooting in one of the rooms involving a drug deal gone bad. Although staff was aware of the shooting, they never called police. Rather, the damage remained and they continued to rent the room. Though there was damage to the room and plywood over one of the windows a bullet had exited out of, people continued to pay money and spend the night in that room. The final story, and probably definitely the most concerning, in April of 2019, a woman staying at one of our problem hotels was the victim of a horrific sexual assault. She was violently and repeatedly raped by two men. When the males left, the victim called the front desk asking for help since her cell phone was dead. Despite this, the staff never called police or went to check on her. When help never came, she finally worked up the courage to run to the desk for help. She told the hotel staff that she had just been raped and needed someone to call police. The hotel staff refused to call 911 and told her she needed to immediately leave or she would be removed. As she was fleeing the hotel, she just happened to find a Roseville sergeant driving through the parking lot. A quote directly from his report. I observed the victim exit the stairwell door. She was barefoot, carrying her socks and shoes, crying hysterically. She appeared disheveled, and her clothing was torn. She kept saying, "They would not help me. I was raped, and they wouldn't help me." Two men were ultimately identified and have been charged with first-degree sexual assault. They're awaiting trial later this month. These are just a few of the many stories our officers see firsthand on a daily basis. Currently, we have very few options to effectively and proactively deal with the criminal activity and public safety concerns occurring in our problem hotels. We absolutely support legislation which would allow more local control to address the increasing issues we have at our hotels. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. Next, I have John Choi from the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. And if you can be succinct in your testimony, we have some questions and we want to get this voted out by 7:05 if we can. Mr. Choi, you're muted.
That's probably the fifth time I've heard that today. But thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I will try to be brief as possible. And thank you to the committee and to Deputy Chief Adams for the prior testimony. For the record, I'm John Choi. I'm the Ramsey County Attorney, and I'm here today to support the efforts of my local community and my police department in Roseville, who have had a history of problem hotels. And this is not isolated, I think, to the city of Roseville. As the county attorney, I'm very aware that many communities have struggled with hotels that have not been cooperating with the police. I come here today because, as some of you may know, I have been a longtime proponent and champion of the work this state has been doing around our response to sexually exploited youth and adults who have been prostituted. And as you know, many of the situations that play out across the state of Minnesota happen at hotels. And we have done a lot of work locally in Ramsey County to engage the hospitality industry, to train frontline staff workers to help be a part of the solution. And so there's a great group of very responsible hotel owners and business community in the city of Roseville that is really committed to ferreting out any type of exploitation and trafficking in that city. And we've had great cooperation from the Minnesota hospitality industry and all of the hotels in Roseville, with the exception of a few. And so it's been to some great frustration on the part of the city to get the attention of these business owners. And so I stand here today to plead to you to give local communities the tools, and this would be one additional tool in the fight against sexual exploitation and trafficking of vulnerable people in our state. You know, I think all of you should be so proud of the work that you have done on a bipartisan basis to create a safe harbor law in the state of Minnesota. But more importantly, unlike anywhere else in the country, you actually funded it. And we today have about 75 shelter beds across the state. We have a regional navigator system. We have law enforcement who are trained and motivated to do these types of trafficking investigations. We have a better response on children who are sexually exploited, who oftentimes are runaways. And I think this adding this tool to local communities is just another part of the toolbox of our response as a state to help local communities combat the exploitation and trafficking of youth. So I urge your support in this legislation. And I want to thank my representative, Jamie Becker Fenn, for her leadership in bringing this forward.
And I see we have a Pat Trungen here to answer questions. And so I'll get to those. Representative Nash, you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And either to the author or the county attorney. So I remember when I was mayor in Waconia, we had the ability to revoke licensure of various establishments, hotels being one of them. Is that not something that's being done? Is that something that this is going to strengthen? I'm just trying to ask that question. And obviously, Representative Becker Fenn, we stand with you in trying to eliminate human trafficking. It just drives me crazy. And as a father of six, I think about things like that regularly. But can you tell me specifically how does this relate to my question, and how does this put more tools in the hands of the localities?
Representative Becker Fenn.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually think Mr. Trudgeon, our city manager, might be best equipped to answer that.
Okay, Mr. Trudgeon, please identify yourself for the record, and then you can proceed with answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Pat Trudgeon. I'm the city manager for the city of Roseville. In response to Representative Nash's question, I would say that currently under state law, there are limitations on when cities can license hotels if they're under the jurisdiction of a local health board. In our case, Ramsey County, we cannot have one unless there's some very extensive process for delegation. Currently, the county of Ramsey does license hotels, but they just do it for sanitation and health reasons and not for criminal activities. So we want to have that ability to do that. Under state law, we're prevented to do that. There are exceptions. If you're a charter city, you have the ability to potentially do that. We are not a charter city, and as many other communities throughout Minnesota are not. So this would give another tool in the toolbox for us to fight this.
Representative Nash, follow up.
Nothing further. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Seeing no hands going up, I'll renew my motion. First, Representative Becker Finn, do you want to do your wrap up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My Wi-Fi is unstable, so I'm going to have to go this route. But I thank members for the support in moving us forward for this really important tool that can be used by our cities to control these kinds of criminal activities in our cities. So thank you for the support.
With that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 702, as amended, be referred to the General Register. Ms. Sprett, can you take the roll?
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
Aye.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski?
No.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative Cleborne?
Aye.
Representative Kosnick?
Aye.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative New Brindley?
Aye.
Representative Pulowski?
Pulowski, aye.
Representative Quam?
Aye.
With a vote of 12 ayes and 1 nay, the motion prevails.
The bill is on its way to the General Register. Thank you. And our next bill is House File 1869. Again, Representative Becker Finn. And I will move to refer House File 1869 to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Ms. Representative Becker Finn, I see there's an A4 amendment. Do we want to put that on first?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
I'll move the author's A4 amendment. Members, all in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Ayes have it. Representative Becker Finn, explain your bill as amended.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you printed this one off, the A4 amendment actually makes it a much smaller bill. This is a bill related to the Safe at Home program that's administered by the Secretary of State's office. And assuming you're somewhat familiar with that program, it allows victims of violence a path to having an address that a separate mailbox that is separate so that their abusers or the perpetrators do not have access to their home address. And with that, this is an agency policy priority. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifier to describe what it does.
With that, a testifier is the first one I have on my list is Sam Bonowitz from the Secretary of State's office. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair, members, my name is Sam Bonowitz, and I am the Director of Government Relations for the Office of the Secretary of State. Representative Becker Finn did a good overview of the Safe at Home program, but it is our state's address confidentiality program for people with very high safety needs, people who fear for their safety, victims of domestic violence and stalking, but also members of our law enforcement. Our program began in 2007. Where there were about a dozen states with a program like Safe at Home, and now there are approximately 40 states with address confidentiality programs. When people enroll, our office assigns them a St. Paul PO box address that all public and private entities must accept and use as the person's real address. It goes on their driver's license, anywhere you provide your address. Safe at home participants provide their safe at home address. The idea being that for the vast majority of participants, only the safe at home office knows the participant's true address. Because most safe at home participants are crime and abuse victims, the use of the safe at home address really allows them the ability to go about their daily life without having their true address accessible to the person they fear. There are very, very rare occasions where another government entity office may need to know a participant's address, such as when a participant purchases a home or when there's a request of social service that must be delivered at a participant's home. And there are instances when a utility company needs to know a service address too. Our office has worked extensively and established special safety protocols for these rare instances, and there are safe at home laws in place for other government offices. But for the most part, the only address a safe at home participant provides is their assigned PO box address. And that's the way the program is truly effective. By using the only assigned address, safe at home is a safety tool. It's an effective strategy for people who need physical safety and emotional security. Since the program's inception, more than 11,000 people have been served. The safe at home office assists participants by forwarding their mail to them, helping them with interactions with third parties, legal compliance, problems with third party stakeholders, and helping participants understand how to use their safe at home address to stay safe. The changes before you today will improve the program's effectiveness for those who fear for their safety. It's primarily a technical bill clarifying existing law and definitions, such as the definition of mail for safe at home purposes. It requires participants submit date of birth on their general notice, so government entities are able to protect the right Sally Smith, for example. This bill also allows participants who submit a notice to a government entity the ability to decide for themselves what information of theirs needs to be protected. Situations are very specific for each participant, and this will afford participants the ability to control who knows what and shares what information, and every person has their own uniquely tailored safety plan. This particular change has been really driven by local government entities with employees that need this flexibility to decide for themselves what is and is not private. Just as an example, employees with public facing jobs like county attorneys or probation officers may want their home addresses protected, but would not be able to fulfill their job duties if the fact that they're an employee of the government entity is protected. This bill also clarifies that real property notices are not just a notice to the county recorder, but also applies to all property records held by a government entity, such as tax and assessment records. Chair members, I will be here for questions, and we also have a few members from the Office of the Secretary of State that will be here should you have any questions. But I think we have two folks from Hennepin County who are here to testify as well. Thank you.
And I have two more testifiers here and a couple people as needed. Members, if you testifiers, if you can keep it to 2 minutes, we have a lot of bills on the agenda, this being first deadline week, and so we need to get through these. So members, the next person on my list is Christy Latte Johnson. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Christy Latte Johnson, and I am the responsible authority and data practices compliance official for Hennepin County. I'd like to thank the Secretary of State's office for the opportunity to work with them to identify technical changes to the safe at home language to help government entities better serve safe at home participants. I'm going to speak specifically to the safe at home general notice, and I have to say Sam did an awesome job. So some of the stuff that I was going to say, I don't really need to say, which is nice. But one of the things that I wanted to mention is that the theme of the bill is really focused on tailoring the protection afforded to the safe at home general notice participant. And like Sam said, it does it in three ways. First, it allows the Secretary of State's office to create a form to collect information local governments need to accurately identify and protect safe at home general notice participants. For example, if we get a safe at home general notice participant with a common name such as Charles Johnson, we may not be able to identify the records needing protecting without additional identifying information like a date of birth. It also requires the safe at home general notice participant to specify location data to be protected, and it creates a default that the participant's location will be protected, but not the identity of the participant unless it's specifically requested by the participant. And Sam gave a great example of county-facing employees who interact, or county employees who interact with the public. If they submit a safe at home general notice, The name and the work location of the employee may be found in hundreds of government documents, and it's not realistic that or even possible for the county to be able to protect those documents, especially if they continue to do their job and would need to send letters or file documents or something like that. At the same time, we do understand and appreciate the fact that participants do desire to protect specific location data. So when we have had people who are employees saying, you know, I'm looking into Safe at Home, and we talk with them about what our capability is, they're like, no, I just want to make sure that my home address is protected. So this gives that opportunity for us to do that and focus specifically on what they want to have protected. That is all I have. If anyone, you know, if we want to turn it over to the next testifier, and then if anyone else has questions, I'm available to answer them.
You want to hang around for questions? That'll be great.
Excellent. I will. Thank you.
And when you talk about common names, I door knocked 7 Michael Nelsons in my district 1 year. So yes, I know all about common names.
Right.
The next person on the list is Amber Boogie. Hope I said that right. Please identify yourself for the record and try and keep your testimony to less than 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Amber Bouget, and I'm the Chief Deputy Recorder for Hennepin County. I would also like to thank the Secretary of State for their continued partnership in refining the Safe at Home laws as they apply to real property. I'll briefly cover the changes in this bill that apply to the Safe at Home real property notice. A real property notice applies prospectively to real property records, which are often public and important to commerce. It protects a Safe at Home participant's identity in connection with a specific property. The proposed changes to the real property notice portion of the statute clarify that the real property notice is not just notice to the county recorder, but also applies to all real property records held by a government entity, such as assessment and taxation records. The amendments clarify that the real property notice, instead of the general notice, applies to real property data outside of the county recorder's office. This includes data about real property held by other government entities, such as a city holding assessment or permit data. In all cases, the real property notice applies prospectively to new data created. These changes also provide for more effective government. The specific changes include changing the definition of real property records to now include data on assessments, data on real or personal property taxation, and other data on real property. The next changes replace the reference to county recorder with government entity throughout to make it clear that the real property notice provisions apply to a government entity who maintains real property records. There are also some minor administrative changes with respect to the information in the notice, as well as notification of termination. The final change is allowing sharing of information between government entities for assessment and taxation purposes. Thank you for your time this evening, and I'll be available for questions as well.
Thank you, Ms. Bouget. With that, members, questions of the bill? Don't see a lot of hands going up. Representative Roskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if Ms. Bonowitz could let us know how many participants in the program and characterize the size of the program over time.
Ms. Bonowitz. Ms. Bonowitz, there we go. You're still muted. Yeah, there we go.
Chair, members, can you hear me?
Yep.
Thank you. Chair and members, I can't speak to necessarily the growth of the program right now. We have continued to grow, but at this time we have over 3,500 participants in the Safe at Home program. We do have a legislative report that we have that I can send you that shows the growth of the program. But as of now, we have over 3,500 participants. With over 1,600 households.
Representative Roskowski, follow up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Ms. Bonowitz. I appreciate seeing that.
That'd be nice to see that. Yeah, you can send that to us. Any other questions? If not, Representative Nash, this is a Caught me a bit before.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've spoken to a number of people who do take advantage of this particular program. Many single women, many divorced moms and such with husbands who are somewhat predatory or predatory, and this affords them the ability to run and own a business and have anonymity that really is an important thing. So I think this is a good bill and we'll be voting yes.
Thank you, Representative Nash. With that, Representative Becker-Finn, if you want to do your wrap up and then we'll get to a vote.
I've got to chair an 8:30 committee in the morning, so I just appreciate the support, Mr. Chair.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House file, the right number here, 1869, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Members, Ms. Spreck will take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Carlson, aye.
Representative Nash?
Aye.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski?
Aye.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative Cleborn?
Aye.
Representative Kosnick?
Aye.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative New Brindley?
Aye.
Representative Pulowski?
Pulowski, aye.
Representative Quam?
Aye.
With a vote of 13 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails.
The motion prevails. The bill's on its way to Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 2080, Representative Schultz. And I'll move to help refer House File 2080 to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. And Representative Schultz, if you want to describe your bill.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. House File 2080 is the Department of Revenue bill, and it's to put the state of Minnesota in compliance. So we've been out of compliance for many years, and this is a real priority for the Department of Revenue. So what it does, we need to start doing fingerprint background investigations. And for all of the employees that use, or vendors that use federal tax information, and a lot of our agencies like DHS, Revenue, they use this information for benefit eligibility termination. So it's important that we're compliant so our agencies can perform their necessary duties. And I think this involves about fingerprinting and background studies of around 4,800 employees and the vendors that we use. So it's really important that we do this. And I hope if you have questions, I believe the Department of Revenue is here to testify and a commissioner. So I think I'll let them explain more of the bill. And if members have questions, to direct it to the Department of Revenue or research.
I have two testifiers on the list, Joanna Bayers and Lee Ho. Who wants to go first? Mr. Ho, identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. For the record, my name is Lee Ho, Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I would like to make a few brief remarks and then take any questions the committee may have. First, I would like to thank Representative Schultz for carrying this bill on behalf of the Department of Revenue and other agencies who use federal tax information, or FTI, to perform their work. House File 2080 brings Minnesota into compliance with Internal Revenue Service Publication 1075, which requires state and local governments that receive FTI to conduct background investigations of individuals with access to FTI and to create a written background check policy. The legislation provides the affected state agencies with authority to fingerprint individuals and conduct national criminal history record checks of individuals with access to federal tax information. These individuals include current or prospective employees of affected agencies, contractors of these agencies, employees or agents of a contractor with these agencies, and any individual otherwise engaged by agencies who have access to federal tax information. Within the last 30 months, the majority of other states have enacted laws regarding fingerprinting of individuals with access to federal tax information. These states have completed or are in the process of implementing their fingerprint-based criminal history checks. This legislation is needed for the Department of Revenue and other agencies that use FTI to administer their programs. Thank you, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. I'll be happy to take any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Ho. And Ms. Byers, do you need to testify or just here to answer questions?
Mr. Chair, I'm just here for questions.
Okay, thank you. First person I see on my list here is Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Ho. Mr. Ho, if Minnesota doesn't comply to this, what does the big bad federal government do to Minnesota?
Mr. Ho.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the danger for all state agencies is that we will not be, our use of federal tax information could be suspended, which in effect might stop some of the program work that we do. In the case of the Department of Revenue, some of that work involves tax research work that generates revenue estimates. It also involves some of the compliance work we do for tax audits to ensure compliance with the tax code.
Representative Drazkowski, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Ho. And I did see that it does include the government agencies and their employees. Do any of the testifiers know to what extent out of those three or four agencies that I read in the bill that the employees are already background checked, or will this be brand new for all of them?
Mr. Ho.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, for many of our employees, we conduct background checks when they first are hired into the department. This requirement will permit us to do regular background checks on the IRS timeline, which is every 5 years.
Representative Drazkowski, final question.
Okay, yeah, I think I've had enough. Mr. Hover, what I was really wondering is what percentage of those agencies that they're already done and have been practicing this, or will this be a brand new practice in those agencies?
Mr. Hall.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, this would be a new practice for these agencies. We don't currently conduct fingerprint background checks.
Thank you, Mr. Hall and Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Give it a second here. If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 2080 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Ms. Spreck will take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
Aye.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski?
Aye.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative Cleborne?
Aye.
Representative Kosnick?
Aye.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative New Brindley?
Aye.
Representative Pulaski?
Pulaski, aye.
Representative Quam?
Aye.
With a vote of 13 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails.
The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to the Judiciary Finance Committee. Members, we were joking before that we were going to do Representative Freiberg's bill at 3:30 in the morning, but Representative Freiberg is the next bill up, House File 1359. And Representative Mason, do you want to move the local government division report?
I so move.
Representative Mason moves the adoption of the local government division report. All members, this is a voice vote. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. With that, I'll move refer House File 1359 to the General Register. And Representative Freiberg, you want to briefly describe your bill, and then we can get to your testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1359 would authorize wastewater operators to establish a program for inflow and infiltration mitigation work on private property. Inflow and infiltration is clear water, that's stormwater or groundwater, that enters the wastewater system through faulty infrastructure, such as cracked or deteriorated pipes or root intrusion. In the metro area, private service laterals connect to city pipes, which connect to the Met Council's regional wastewater system. Bond funds and fee revenue can be used for publicly owned infrastructure, but there's no program to assist with INI mitigation on private property. Inspections typically cost around $200. Repairs can range from $2,000 to $10,000 for homeowners. The Metropolitan Council Environmental Services estimates that about 20% of annual flow treated at wastewater plants is INI. Cities and townships in the area report that at least 50% of INI comes from private properties. The Met Council has been able to defer capacity improvements estimated at $1 billion that would have been required had INI not been addressed through the public INI program. The regional population has increased by 12% since 2005, and that's been accommodated within the existing regional collection system, and there's also been an increase in annual precipitation. Mitigation work in preventing INI is more cost efficient than building larger and additional infrastructure to treat clear water in the system. The Met Council proposes to allocate a small portion of their PAYGO capital program funded through the municipal wastewater charge to offset this effort. Details of the program would be established through a public process with stakeholder engagement, and it would be adopted by the Met Council. I do have a couple people from the Met Council here to answer any questions that may come up. I'm also happy to respond to any that come up, but I think that's about it as far as the author presentation.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. I have, it looks like, five people on my list, and I'm again is going to ask you to try and keep your comments within under 2 minutes or around 2 minutes. Everyone seems to take that as a challenge to go farther when I say that, but I'll start with Janine Clancy, the Assistant General Manager of the Environmental Services for the Met Council. Ms. Clancy, if you want to introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much. My name is Janine Clancy. I'm an Assistant General Manager with the Metropolitan Council Environmental Services. And the Metropolitan Council has been working with the cities that it serves since 2003 to address INI in our wastewater collection system. And indeed, as Representative Freiberg said, INI is a challenge because 20% of the wastewater that we treat is actually stormwater that does not need to be treated at the wastewater treatment plant. And this, in fact, takes up capacity and actually poses additional risk to the system, particularly in wet weather events. And so we are very supportive of this initiative. We want to work with our customers to develop the program if we get the authority to do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Clancy, and you were really good about being under 2 minutes. The next person on my list is Brooke Bordson. If you want to identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brooke Bordson, and I'm with the Met Council Government Affairs, just here to answer question or follow up with any information members had.
Thank you. The next person I have on my list is it Kyle Colvin or Colvin Kyle? I think it's Kyle Colvin. It's
yes,
welcome
Mr.
to
Chair.
The committee. And yeah, what was on my agenda was they put your name first or last name first, but proceed with your testimony after you identify yourself.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kyle Colvin. I am the manager of the Wastewater Planning and Communities Programs Group at the Metropolitan Council. One of my primary responsibilities is to implement the council's regional INI program. I've been involved in that program since its inception in 2007. I'm primarily here just to answer any questions that the committee might have regarding the proposed bill change.
Thank you, Mr. Colvin. The next person I have on my list is Patricia Nauman, and identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to comment tonight. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. I'll be extremely brief. I just wanted to first start out by saying Metro Cities has worked very closely with the Metropolitan Council on issues with inflow and infiltration, excess inflow and infiltration for cities, and recognizes that these problems are best addressed at the local level in order to alleviate the need for additional regional wastewater capacity to be built to address this problem of clean water entering the system. Metro Cities does not have a specific policy on the council's use of the charge in this fashion. What our policy does stipulate is that we support a process by which local officials can provide input into any program that would be established at the regional level. And I have heard Met Council staff say that many times and trust that they will, but that's simply, I am reflecting what the organization's policy explicitly states. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. And I have a question for Ms. Clancy. My first house I had, there was an issue, it was in Minneapolis, but they were doing separating the storm sewers. A lot of the older parts of town had storm sewers and sanitary sewers that ran together. Have we gotten most of those separated out throughout the metro area where we do have two separate systems and no longer the system where they all dump into one? Ms. Clancy.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I am pleased to report that about 3 years ago, the Metropolitan Council, in conjunction with the City of Minneapolis, was able to request that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency terminate the jointly held combined sewer overflow permit. So in other words, we have had enough system performance that shows that we have separated to the extent where we are not at risk at overflowing on consistent basis in wet weather events. And this is a remarkable thing to report because we are the only large metropolitan area in the country to be able to successfully do this. We want to make sure that we can keep in compliance with this INI mitigation program. So thank you for the question.
With that, thank you. Representative Druskowski, you've got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know who it's for, maybe one of the testifiers, but is there any point at which a homeowner in this program can be mandated by the local government to be part of? Is it all voluntary? I do see some words around compliance, et cetera, so if you could help with that question.
Representative Freiberg or one of your testifiers?
Well, I guess the one thing I would say is this program is just to assist with the financing of any improvements that homeowners might make to their projects. So in that sense, it's voluntary. It's possible cities may adopt mandatory requirements for sewer repairs, but those would be completely independent of this bill. The sole purpose of this bill is to enable the Met Council to create a program that would assist with the financing of it. But perhaps Ms. Clancy has additional information.
Ms. Clancy?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that is exactly as I would have answered the question. It is a financing program. The Met Council asked local communities to develop a strategy that best address private property INI, and that's based on the impact and the issues that the community is facing itself.
Representative Druskowski, follow-up.
One quick question, Mr. Chair, and that is, I see on line 1.14 of the bill, we strike the word council. Does that mean that the hearing will be becoming before appointed officials in the city rather than the elected people in the city?
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Druskowski. I think the main purpose of that change is just to make the language align with the change in the definition of city that was made. As you can see in the first part of the bill, it redefines a city. Again, this is just for purposes of the INI financing program, but it redefines the term city to also include a township or any political subdivision of the state with sewer ownership. So then that basically means the Met Council in this sense. So since the Met Council and townships don't have a city council, it would just be the governing body and, you know, the Township Board of Supervisors, the Met Council itself, or the City Council. That would be how I would interpret it.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg.
Members, any other questions? Give it a couple seconds here. If not, thank you, Representative Freiberg. You want to wrap up?
Thanks. INI has been a big issue in the area I represent for a long time, and homeowners are making improvements to their sewer lines. They're not always glamorous changes to make, and it's kind of an invisible improvement to the house, but it is a really important one.
I think he just froze up.
You know, the purpose of protecting the house from backups, but also the regional wastewater treatment facility. So It is expensive though for homeowners, and this would be a helpful tool to help homeowners make these improvements that can actually help protect the environment of the region. So I would encourage members to support this.
And with that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 1359 be referred to the General Register. Ms. Breck, take the roll.
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Nash.
Aye.
Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Cleborne.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative New Brindley.
Aye.
Representative Pulaski.
Pulaski, aye.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
With a vote of 13 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails.
Motion prevails. The bill is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. The next bill on our agenda is House File 801. Representative Morrison, and I'll move that House File 801 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Morrison, you want to describe your bill? And I see there's an A4 amendment. Do you want that put on first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for not being on camera, but I seem to have very unstable internet, so I am on my phone without video. And yes, I would like to move the amendment, please.
I'll move the A4 amendment, the author's amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. The bill's amended. Representative Morrison, you want to describe your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 801, which would establish a prescription drug affordability board to give the state the ability to limit how much Minnesotans pay for certain high-cost drugs. I'd like to give a brief overview of the authority of the Prescription Drug Affordability Board and the need for this board, and I'll focus my comments on the provisions in the bill related to establishing the board under the Legislative Coordinating Commission, Section 3 and Section 8, which authorizes the Office of the Attorney General to enforce the law, along with the changes in the amendment. And the AG's office is here to answer questions related to their role. The cost of prescription drugs continues to skyrocket in the United States, making it difficult for Minnesotans to afford their prescriptions. Unless we do more to keep costs down, more people will not be able to afford their drugs, leading to poorer health outcomes and higher healthcare costs. This legislation is based on a National Academy of State policy model. At least 6 other states have implemented prescription drug affordability initiatives, including Maryland, Maine, New Hampshire, New York, Massachusetts, and Ohio. By addressing the high cost of drugs, we can lower the high cost of healthcare and health insurance. This proposal was one of the top strategies of the Blue Ribbon Commission charged with finding savings in the state budget. I just want to give a couple examples of the skyrocketing drug prices that we're seeing. The cost of Bavencio, for example, a new cancer drug that was approved several years ago, is $156,000 a year per patient. The new muscular dystrophy drug came on the market for an eye-popping price of $300,000 annually. In 2016, the FDA approved a new bladder cancer treatment that costs $12,500 a month, or $150,000 a year. Even older drugs that have been on the market are not immune. The cost of insulin, as we well know, has tripled between 2002 and 2013, despite no notable changes in formulation. And the 4-decade-old EpiPen, a life-saving allergy medication, has seen a price hike of 500% since 2007. Clearly, more needs to be done to rein in the high cost of medications. The Prescription Drug Affordability Board would be an independent body that evaluates drug prices and sets an upper payment limit if a drug's price is excessive and prevents an affordability challenge for the state's health system or patients. The payment limit applies throughout the state healthcare system to protect consumers, state and local governments, health plan companies, providers, pharmacies, and other stakeholders. The overarching goal of a Prescription Drug Affordability Board is to find the upper payment limit at which insurers, purchasers, and government programs can afford to provide the drug to everyone in the state who needs it. The point of an upper payment limit is to expand sales and patient access, not to reduce manufacturer revenue. Under the amendment that we just adopted, the Legislative Coordinating Commission is authorized to establish the Independent Prescription Drug Affordability Board, whose members have relevant experience and are without conflicts of interest and are appointed by the governor and the majority and minority leads in the House and Senate. The bill also establishes a 12-member advisory council to provide advice to the board, and it will be made up of stakeholders, including drug manufacturers, employers, health plan companies and providers, researchers, advocates, and state government. The amendment also establishes the frequency of the meeting for the advisory council, as that was not clear in the bill. Not all drugs would be reviewed by the Affordability Board, and there are no new reporting requirements for drug manufacturers. Instead, the legislation builds off the Prescription Drug Transparency Act passed last year, allowing the board to review transparency reporting and other publicly available pricing data to identify any increases in drug prices above the threshold set in the law for brand name, generic, biosimilar, and biologic drugs. Under Section 3, the board will hire an executive director and other staff who will serve in the unclassified service. The director must have knowledge and expertise in pharma economics, pharmacology, health service, or medicine. The board may also employ contract for professional assistance as necessary to perform the board's duties. The board will not receive reimbursement except for expenses. And Section 8 allows for the Office of the Attorney General to enforce and pursue remedies if it finds that an entity was non-compliant with the board's upper payment limit requirements. In addition, there's also an appeals process established in law so that any persons affected by the decision of the commission may request an appeal within 30 days of the date of the decision. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. I have two people as testifiers, and I have three people who have are here to answer questions, I understand. The first person on my list is Travis Paulson. If you would identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, and try and keep it till around 2 minutes.
I'll be brief. Thank you, Chairman Nelson and members of the committee. My name is Travis Paulson. I'm a resident of Eveleth, Minnesota. I'm a type 1 diabetic, and I lead an advocacy organization that's dedicated to organizing patients and fighting back against the high prescription drug costs and running Caravans to Canada. I was diagnosed as a type 1 diabetic at the age of 14, but I was fortunate that my mother at the time could afford my insulin at about $8 a vial. By the time I was 30, the price had skyrocketed. I had a reality check when my insulin was about $300 a vial. For me, that's roughly $1,500 a month to stay alive. So the financial toll is overwhelming. And once the 2007 financial crisis hit, I had lost everything. I ended up traveling around the country, working odd jobs, warehouse jobs, anything I could do just to earn enough money to ration medication and stay alive. My health is what ultimately paid the price. I began rationing insulin with the hopes that I could make it last longer. Eventually, I'd run out, and many times I was forced to go without my insulin entirely. I've learned since then that many people have died doing that. I'm very lucky to have not died, but unfortunately, many years of rationing and going without insulin caused long-term complications. I've had 35 eye surgeries. The insides of my eyes are completely rebuilt with lenses and everything you could imagine. So really, the situation's not unique. There's drug prices are just out of control in this country, and it's causing serious consequences for Minnesotans and patients all across the country with the excessive cost to the state leading to medical problems. So we really just need our state government to pass this House File 801. It will increase transparency and allow pricing practices of drug companies to be reviewed, because their bottom line is if drugs aren't going to work, if people can't afford them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Paulson. The next person on my list is Peter Fjellstead. I hope I said that right. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chair Nelson. Hopefully you and the members of the committee can hear me. Good afternoon. My name is Peter Fjellstead, and I'm Senior Director of State Policy for Pharma, a trade association of 33 biopharmaceutical manufacturers that make brand name medicines that save and improve lives every day. Today, I respectfully oppose House File 801 because it imposes a harmful price control through an upper payment limit, which could restrict patient access to their own medicines and discourage research and development of new treatments and cures. We believe the bill fails to consider the real problem regarding the cost of prescription drugs, which is an individual's health plan benefit design. In fact, it doesn't take into account that the growth rate of prescription drug costs has slowed in recent years. In fact, prescription medicines account for only about 3% of the Medicaid budget in Minnesota for the recent figures available. And additionally, retail prescription drug medicine prices for brand name drugs grew just at 1.7% on average, which is below the rate of inflation for the third year in a row. Moreover, 90% of Americans consume generic drugs, which are pennies on the dollar. Those instances where drugs are exorbitant in costs are very regrettable. However, they are outliers. Next, this bill doesn't recognize that price controls on brand name medicines raise significant legal concerns. It raises legal concerns under federal and state law related to the potential disclosure of trade secret information, particularly by allowing the Prescription Drug Affordability Board created by this bill to determine what qualifies as proprietary. We believe that the bill would establish a new level of bureaucracy on top of last year's prescription drug price transparency bill, which doesn't even collect the information designated for manufacturers to submit until October of 2021, which is 7 months from now, for an MDH report to be delivered to the legislature in January. We believe this is an instance of getting the cart before the horse. Two more quick points. We believe that this may harm Minnesota's economy, especially during the ongoing pandemic. I'd just like to react to a couple of the things that have been said about the Affordability Board. In those states that have enacted affordability boards, you haven't seen much real work in order to drive down the costs of prescription drugs for consumers. In fact, Maryland's been a leader in establishing their affordability board, and other states have modeled their legislation on such. If you read the meeting minutes for any affordability board meeting in Maryland, they've done really nothing except for organize and set up different officers for the affordability boards. No real work has been done for the last couple of years that it's been in existence, and that's because they haven't been able to figure out what exactly to do. If the intent of the bill is to drive down costs for patients who need assistance in affording their tools, I'd like to direct you to Medicine Assistance Tool that we've developed over 950 programs. That's MAP.org for patients in need. In closing, thank you, Chair Nelson and committee members, for your time today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. I've got Stefan Guildmeister and Jason Plagenkuhl and Carly Moline to answer questions. With that, members, any questions of the members? I don't see any questions, so Representative Morrison, you want to wrap up, and then we'll get proceed to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to present House Bill 801. As Mr. Paulson said it so well, if drugs don't work, if people can't afford them, and we need to take action so that Minnesotans can afford the medications they need to survive and thrive. Thank you.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 801, as amended, be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Ms. Spreck, can you take the roll?
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Cleborne.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick.
No.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative New Brindley.
No.
Representative Pulaski.
Pulaski, aye.
Representative Quam.
No.
With a vote of 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails.
The motion prevails. The bill's on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Morrison. The next bill on our agenda is House File 58, Representative Elkins. And Representative Elkins, do you want to make your motion?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we re-refer this bill back to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy.
Thank you. And there was an amendment, but it's not going to be offered anymore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so we're referring this back to Health, Finance, and Policy because in the end, this will probably end up with, by the time the dust settles, with fiscal notes under the jurisdiction of three different committees. And there seems to be a consensus of the committee chairs that the best place to lay this over is in Health, Finance, and Policy.
Okay, thank you. You want to describe your bill then?
Yep, so what this bill does is there are two articles to it. The first one essentially requires the drug manufacturers to reveal their prices in advance and then hold to them for the course of the plan year. And then with that done, the second article of the bill requires the health plans and their pharmacy benefit management companies to observe certain restrictions in their ability to change their formularies over the course of the year. And there's also a provision that will require the health plans to move in the direction of implementing the e-prescribing capability as well. So for tonight, there's really the one thing that puts this bill under the jurisdiction of this committee is that we have received a rather substantial fiscal note from MMB and the State Employee Group Insurance Plan related to one particular provision in Article 2. So if you want to play by the scorecard, we're back on page 15 of the bill under formulary changes. So the bill has been characterized as a formulary freeze bill. It is not a formulary freeze bill. It allows a health plan and its PBM to make changes by expanding its formulary to add drugs, reduce copayments or insurance, or move a drug to a benefit category that reduces an enrollee cost. And even it allows a health plan to remove a brand name drug from the formulary if a new equivalent generic is being introduced upon 60 days notice. And allows a health plan and its PBM to change the utilization review procedures for a drug, again, all on 60 days notice. So the one thing that is a significant restriction on what the plans and the PBMs can do right now, and the main benefit of this provision is that it does require that if a health plan enrollee has enrolled in a particular plan because the plan description showed that the drug that they were already taking was covered in a certain way on that plan, that during the course of the plan year, the plan and the PBM cannot force the enrollee off of that drug that was available to them under certain conditions, certain prices when they enrolled in the plan. So the reason that we're here to talk about this fiscal note is that the State Employee Group Insurance Plan, of course, has a drug formulary for its state employee members. And in this plan, CGIP has contracted with a PBM, CVS Caremark, to administer the drug formulary that's part of their health plan. And under the contract that CGIP currently has with CVS Caremark, there's a poison pill, as I like to refer to it, that says that if the plan implements any restrictions on CVS Caremark's ability to utilize that, manage the formula in order to minimize costs or maximize rebates, then the provision in the plan is in the contract is triggered, which bumps CGIP off of the contract they're on and onto a less favorable custom contract. And the main consequence of that is that CGIP loses half of its about $50 million a year in rebate revenue that CVS Caremark would otherwise pass along to CGIP. So the issue which I've been exploring and had a very productive conversation this morning with MMB and CGIP about this is that the current contract between MMB, CGIP, and CVS Caremark expires at the end of 2022. This bill is effective for the plan year that begins on January 1st, 2023. So at the beginning of next year, MMB, CGIP will be putting out the PBM contract for the 2023 plan year at the beginning of the year. They will select a new vendor, a new contract to negotiate the plan and implement the plan for 2023. And that's not what's reflected in the fiscal note. What's reflected in the fiscal note is the continuation of the current contract with the current vendors from into 2023 and beyond, including this poison pill provision that is adding $25 million a year, essentially, to the fiscal note. If you look at the fiscal note, it only shows $13 million for 2023, but that's because it's a fiscal year and you've only got 6 months of the impact. So the tails on this fiscal note look really, really ugly. It was reflecting the full $25 million loss in rebates plus inflation. So my problem with this is that the way that MMB and LBO are interpreting the requirements for fiscal note construction is that they have to use the current year as a baseline year, which is reasonable. But they're also saying that even though we know right now that current contract is going to expire before this bill goes into effect, they're still going to use the current contract to evaluate the cost of this bill. So there is an alternative way that could be done because courtesy of the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, the trade association for the PBMs, they just issued this new report. It's the bottom thing on the list of attachments for the meeting. And it's a report that was commissioned for them by Milliman. And it's called Estimated Cost of Potential Frozen Formulary Legislation. I'm going to cut straight to the summary of what they say on page 3. If provisions, including restrictions on new generic medications or new brand medications, were implemented nationally, we estimate payer prescription drug costs in the fully insured commercial health insurance market could increase by 1.1 to 1.8%. And five-year aggregated prescription drug costs for fully insured commercial payers for 21 to 2025 relative to the current environment. So if you use that methodology to estimate the actual cost of this fiscal note instead, just took the midpoint of that 1.1 to 1.8% range or 1.145% and applied it to CGIP's 2020 actual net drug spend of $141 million, that would come out to a fiscal impact of about $2 million a year. And the provisions in this bill are actually much less severe than the assumptions reflected in this fiscal note. And in fact, in the appendix of this Milliman report, they estimated the total cost for all commercial plans by state, and according to their report, the total impact of provisions like this on all of the commercial health plans in the state combined would be $11 million in 2021 for every commercial health plan in the state. And I'm looking at a fiscal note here that says this is going to cost the state, $13 million in 2023 and $27 million in fiscal 2024. And it is absolutely strains credulity. So I don't know what we do about this, but it's ridiculous. In my conversation, with MMB and CGIP, I mean, basically it was, yeah, you're basically right, Representative Elkins, but the way we read the fiscal note requirements, and I've had a note from Joe Harney in the LBO office, basically says fiscal notes are based on changes to an agency's current law budget, which include in this case the current contract and not the outcome of negotiations of a future contract. So I have described this as Kafkaesque. It's like the ultimate catch-22. It's like you could never change this provision in law, because you would, if, as long as these poison pills were in the current contract, you could never assume them away.
Representative Elkins, now we'll get to your testifiers. I have Mr. Peter Pjeldsted from Pharma. You want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. Good evening again. My name is Peter Pjeldsted, Senior Director of State Policy for Pharma, Trade Association of 33 Biopharmaceutical Manufacturers. Today, I respectfully oppose Representative Elkins' House File 58. First, I'd like to say we do appreciate Representative Elkins' bill and all the work he's done on it because of the fact that it takes a look at the entire pharmaceutical supply chain by, we believe, shining some light on what health plans and their contracted pharmacy benefit managers are doing with drug benefits that they administer, specifically with the language that Representative Elkins has included in Article 2 of those bill of his bill. Those provisions in the bill that deal with the issues will be particularly helpful in determining why manufacturer rebates or coupons aren't reaching consumers at the pharmacy counter or when they order from their mail-in pharmacy. The truth is that we believe that the rising costs of drugs that anybody's experiencing in this country is due to health plan benefit design, and it has led to increasingly common instances of Minnesotans not seeing their health insurance adjust prices to their medicines at a reasonable cost. Second, it's not true that drug prices are continually rising. I had stated before tonight that in 2019, retail brand drugs increased on an average of 1.7%. Again, below the rate of inflation for the third year in a row. Third, we do worry about the ability of patient access, and we know that the new fiscal note has $50 million as a result of the potential loss of coupons for CGIP in the future. Fourth, regarding the additional manufacturing reporting requirements contained in House File 58, again, we don't supply any information to MDH until about 7 months from now, based on the 2020 transparency law, which won't be delivered to legislators until January 22, 2022. Again, getting the cart before the horse, we believe. We believe that the harmful price control contained in this bill actually would violate federal patent law, and we're very concerned about that. That's on line 7.11 to 7.16. Let me give a quick mention of www.mat.org, the Medicine Assistance Tool of 950 programs for individuals to use to lower their prescription drug costs. In closing, thank you, Chair Nelson and committee members for your time tonight. I stand for any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Pjeldsted. Next person I have is Leanne Gassaway. If you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, and hopefully you can hear me. My name is Leanne Gassaway. I'm the Vice President of Stakeholder Affairs for CVS Health, and I was asked to present to you some information about the fiscal note tonight, and so I want to just quickly run through that. Under Article 2, Section 3, Subdivision 3 is the what I will refer to as almost frozen formulary provision of the bill, as the Representative Elkins has accurately described it. It does allow some changes to the formulary, but it definitely puts one hand behind our back in terms of trying to get some lower cost alternatives on there that are not generic. So I want to explain the fiscal note and how CVS Health and CVS Caremark in particular came up with the fiscal note that was presented to MMB. When we evaluated the state health plan's pharmacy benefit, we went through three steps. The first step, we looked and said, what changes would we need to make to the pharmacy benefit to make it comply with this provision? And what this would require is the state health plan to move from what's called a managed formulary to an open formulary plan. And so looking at that kind of experience, we looked at other clients who had made that shift. An open formulary plan is available in the market. It would be included in the RFP in 2023 if this kind of provision was required in the RFP. So that product is available. Some employers do select it. So we looked at those clients who had gone from a managed formulary to an open formulary plan and what kind of experience they had in drug costs and drug trends as they made that move. And then we applied that real-world experience to the state health plan's claims and drug utilization data so that we had some real world experience that we could apply to the state's own utilization and drug data. And from that, the outcome of applying that resulted in the estimation of rebates of about $25 million that would be forfeited under that type of change. And just to note, the state health plan is a 100% pass-through health plan. So all of that rebate money goes back to the state, back to CGIP. It does not stay with Caremark. So this would be savings directly that goes back to the state to offset drug costs within the state health plan benefit design. Just to give you a little bit of understanding of what an open formulary product, the impacts that open formulary product is, one is just to start with specialty drugs. In the state health plan itself, this is actual data for the Minnesota State Health Plan. They spent about $54 million between January and June of 2020 on specialty drugs, which was about 50% of total gross costs, but represented only 1.7% of all total prescriptions under the state health plan. And this is the type of drugs that was referred to with the previous bill, very high cost, a lot of them extremely cutting edge, and a lot of them are starting to face what we call Me Too competition. And so I will note that in most of these types of drugs that come to market in the brand space, 64% of them do not have any rebates, according to AHIP's research that was released in 2018. So the myth that there's rebates on every single drug that's on the formulary is untrue. And the fact that 64% of brand drugs typically do not have rebates is where we want to be able to bring competition in when there is a market change. And that's kind of the second piece, which is this bill or limiting these kind of formulary altercations mid-cycle would reduce the ability of the state health plan to react to market changes. So just how that runs essentially is that when a Me Too drug comes onto the market, we are able to pit those two drugs against each other. And again, I go back to the AHIP study, which actually looked at real rebate data. And the average rebate, the average discount on brand-to-brand competition was a 39% discount on brand-name drugs. And that's the kind of savings that we're talking about being able to deliver to the state. And so if I have to keep the red pill, if you will, on the formulary, and I can only add the blue pill, but I can't do anything to where the red pill is, then the red pill manufacturer has no reason to negotiate with me to try to lower its net cost to compete with the blue pill, who may have come in lower, but it doesn't make a difference because I have to remain, they have to remain in that preferred formulary status, and I cannot move them to a lower status on the formulary to incent folks to go to the blue pill, which is therapeutically equivalent but less cost. And so there is no reason for a pharmaceutical manufacturer to negotiate with us on behalf of the state to get that lower drug cost onto a formulary or to reduce their cost to remain on the formulary, which is another tool we also use. And I also want to point out that there is a solution. I don't want to always come talking about problems. I like to bring solutions when I testify. We do have a formulary exceptions process. It's been in place since 2014 under the Affordable Care Act. It allows quick, timely physician review of a non-formulary exceptions process, either in a continuity of care opportunity where a formulary change has happened and the person has a continuity of care reason to stay on that drug, or it's a drug that's not on the formulary and it's more medically necessary for them to stay on that drug that's not on the formulary. That allows a physician reviewer to make that decision with the treating physician in a timely and expeditious way. So in closing, I just want to thank the Minnesota legislator for being very aggressive against drug makers in your quest for transparency. You have been a leader in this area, and we stand ready with you and the state health plan in efforts to lower drug costs for all patients. Thank you.
Madam Chair. Thank you.
Do we have additional testifiers?
I've got an additional testifier, yes, and then we got
I want to have a question, but I can wait until the other testifiers have testified.
Fine. Next person on my list is Brett Michelin. Mr. Michelin, please state your name for the tape.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Brett Michelin with the Association for Accessible Medicines. AAM represents the generic and biosimilar manufacturers. And in light of the motion, I'm going to curtail the bulk of my testimony tonight, but there are a couple of points I still want to make. And I think one of the most basic ones is in light of pretty much all the testimony that's gone on, the fiscal note that's been attached to this bill, I think one thing has become very clear is that this bill really just doesn't apply to generic drugs. Even the 25 most expensive generic drugs are less than 1% of health plan premiums. This is budget dust for the health plans. In fact, the total cost for all generic drugs, as put out by the Kaiser Family Foundation, is only 3%. So the concerns in the bill, which are in two sections, where it requires the manufacturer to report the wholesale acquisition cost, could actually be harmful to the patients. Think of a drug like Prozac, the generic form of Prozac. There's 38 manufacturers. If the state is required to put a list out of all the prices, all the WAC prices for that one drug, you're going to have 38 different prices. A patient's going to look at that list, and they're going to see one rate for $1.61, another one for $790. None of that actually even applies to how the patient is going to pay the bill when they show up at the pharmacy. That price is being set by the PBM and the insurer. So this is a potential of causing confusion, and it's not going to increase the competition between generic manufacturers. It's not going to decrease the costs that generic manufacturers are charging. And because of that, there's just really no reason that this should be applying to generic drugs. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Representative Elkins, quickly, and then we've got questioners. I don't. Representative New has been patiently waiting. Representative Elkins, quickly.
Question for each of the last two testifiers, or just a point with respect to the last one. The bill doesn't excludes any bill that costs less than $100 for a month's supply, which excludes the vast majority of generic drugs. But right now, my wife is taking a generic drug that costs $192 a month to her. I mean, it's a lot more expensive for that. But I have questions from Ms. Gassaway. Ms. Gassaway, are you familiar with the Milliman report that the PCMA published just recently?
Ms. Gassaway.
Chairman Nelson, Representative Elkins, yes, I am.
All right, so all of the dynamics that you described in your testimony are also, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, Ms. Gassaway. So all of the dynamics that you described in your testimony are also described in great length within the Milliman report. What happens when a cheaper brand comes onto the market? What happens when a new generic comes onto the market that's chemically equivalent to an existing drug? And yet, you know, they came to the conclusion that the erosion in the ability of a PBM to negotiate discounts and rebates, I agree that anytime you put any kind of restriction on a PBM's ability to manage the formulary, there's going to be a cost to it. But there's a big difference in cost between what Milliman estimates, which is 1.1 to 1.8%, and the $25 million on $144 million spend. That's a lot more than 2%. How would you explain the discrepancy between the estimates you're providing us today and the estimates that are provided in the PCMA's own report?
Representative Elkins, we'll go to the member questions now. Representative New Brindley, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And Representative Elkins, we missed something in your bill introduction. You talked a lot about why the fiscal note is flawed, but you didn't discuss much about the bill itself. And so I'm wondering if you can just briefly talk about the concept of the bill, and the goal is what I'm really looking for. What's the goal of this bill?
The reason
Representative Elkins, briefly, yeah. And
very briefly, because I represented our chair and Representative New Brindley. The bill has been heard in both Commerce and Health, Finance, and Policy. The bill is only here for the purposes of discussing this fiscal note.
the CKIP parts of the fiscal note. It's our jurisdiction. Correct.
Yeah.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that, but that doesn't tell me the goal of the bill. I guess I would assume the goal of the bill, and maybe I will be corrected. I would assume the goal of the bill is to reduce the cost of prescription medications through these transparency measures. And I'm a little concerned. I appreciate Representative Elkins' explanation. However, even if we use the Milliman report as Representative Elkins suggested, that would still raise the cost by about $2 million. We're still increasing the cost. So I'm not real sure where we're going with that. Also, anyone bidding on a CGIP contract, even if we don't go with CVS, even assuming all of Representative Elkins' assumptions are true, even if we bid new contracts, anyone bidding on that is still going to want to do a non-customized formulary. So, I mean, it's how they save money. And so I just don't think that there's any reason to believe that a new contract or a new vendor wouldn't incur the same costs. Mr. Chair, I have a question for you, Mr. Chair, actually. I'm wondering, once we do have those final numbers on CGIP, will this bill come back to our committee so we can evaluate that final appropriate fiscal note?
I don't know. That's a possibility. That's the most I can say right now, because I don't know what's going to happen when it gets back to HH or Health, Finance, and Policy. But I'm assuming so that there may be an amendment to take some of that, deal with some of that, but I'm assuming it might have to come back to us. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it.
And Representative Elkins, what coming out of construction, you have contractors that bid jobs, and then at the end, the owner or the architect wants to make changes, and that happens. I think that's how I'm interpreting what's happening with CVS Pharmacy, is that because we're changing the contract, every good contractor has a pocket change orders, because when you get a change order on a project that was bid, it now becomes a time and material job, not the bid price you originally got. And that raises the cost. And a lot of times contractors, they make their money on those change orders. They bid jobs to the bone. They're barely making money, but the change orders are where they make their money. And that's in my head, that's how it's looking at.
Mr. Chair, I think that's a pretty good analogy, but the difference is that this contract will be done at the end of 2022, and we'll be entering into a brand new contract, and these provisions will be part of the spec. Therefore, all of the companies who are bidding for the contract will know what the parameters are. These will be included in those parameters. We're starting from scratch, and they'll be looking at this the same way, using the framework that was described in the Milliman report.
Fine. Representative Bonner, you have a question, and then hopefully we don't have any more hands up, we'll get to a vote on this. Representative Bonner.
I'll make a brief statement, and then I do actually have a question. The first is that we seem to have lost a little bit of track of the whole intent of this bill. The reality is that we ask folks each year to sign on the dotted line and sign up for a contract. And we hold those individuals to that contract for a one-year term. And many times people are choosing the contract that they do with a healthcare firm based on the formulary. And they're doing that because often they are on critical medications that they need to sustain life or to maintain a chronic condition. And what we're essentially saying here to them is we're going to ask the consumer to adhere to a contract, but then we're going to change the rules of the game midstream and basically pull a bait and switch on them with the formulary. That's essentially what we're saying. And Representative Elkins' bill is really trying to be thorough and thoughtful in finding a way to address that issue to better represent the interests of the consumer. So just wanted to be clear about that point. And the other point is that I would actually really like to hear the answer from Ms. Gassaway that Representative Elkins posed.
Ms. Gassaway, if you remember the question he posed.
Yes, I do, Chair Nelson. Chair Nelson, Representative Bonner. The methodology in the Millenman report is based on estimated rebates and estimated generic utilization based on trends. The estimate that we gave in the fiscal note is based on the real data of the state health plan itself. And so it's a little bit of a estimate versus a real analysis of the real drugs and the real trends and the real rebates the state is accepting today. And so it's a little bit different methodology. And we looked at it again from a compliance perspective, not looking at it as if, okay, so if you negate this generic trend and you negate these rebate trends, this is what your estimated impact is on a national basis, which is what the Milliman report does. We looked at it as how do we comply with this bill in Minnesota statute? And this bill would require an open formulary plan, and we wanted to apply real data to that compliance requirement so that we could keep the state understanding, even if it happens 2 years from now, what kind of construct it is buying into for the next RFP cycle. And so this is our estimate is based on the state health plan's real data and its real rebates that it gets from CVS Caremark, as opposed to aggregated rebates and aggregated drug trends that are outlined in the Milliman report.
Thank you, Ms. Gassaway. Follow up, Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that answer. And really, I guess the one thing that I would just say in comment is that I think that the concept of having this piece in the contract seems to me a little bit out of line with the goals of the state. And I certainly hope that when the state renegotiates that contract, that we use this as a lesson learned to make sure that can't happen again. And certainly, of course, Ms. Gassaway, I hope that your new RFPs will also take that into account.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Nash, I guess you get the final question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, members, we heard early on from Representative Elkins that I believe his words were, the sole reason that we have this bill here before us is because of the fiscal note. That's well established by him. Representative Bonner came back and retorted that we're losing track of the intent of this bill. Well, according to Representative Elkins, the only reason we're talking about this bill is because of the fiscal note, which is groaning under its own weight. It's exceptionally expensive. And after Representative New pointed out, it's going to actually increase another $2 million. I mean, this is reckless and irresponsible. And the fiscal note's not even done. It's going to get bigger. So I think this is really a piece of work, and I can't imagine that there's any reason that we would put up a yes vote for this. You've heard from your own state agency that this is an expensive endeavor. That's irresponsible. I would encourage members to do the right thing, to do the smart thing, to follow the advice of the state and vote no on this. This is bonkers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. And with not that, Representative Elkins, you want to do a quick wrap up and then renew your motion.
Yeah, and to be clear, Representative Nash, Ms. Gassaway is an employee of CVS Caremark, not CVS. The important benefit in this provision of this bill is that people ought to be able to, when they sign up for a health plan, on the basis of their drug that they're taking being covered in the formulary, that contract is honored for the course of the year. And the Milliman report estimates that with drugs costing 20% of the cost of our healthcare premiums, in order to provide this additional protection, the total increase in the health plan premiums would range from 0.2 to 0.4% a year. I think most of us would agree that amount of an increase in our healthcare premiums would be worth gaining that extra protection to know that we can continue to take the drugs that we're counting on. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll just renew my motion that we re-refer this bill back to Health Finance and Policy.
Representative Elkins renews his motion that House File 58 be re-referred to the Health Finance and Policy Committee. Ms. Spreck, can you take the roll?
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
No way.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Dreskowski?
No.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative New Brindley?
No.
Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, aye.
Representative Quam?
No.
With a vote of 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails.
The motion prevails. The bill's on its way back to Health, Finance, and Policy. And hopefully, Representative Elkins, some of these things can get worked out and as this moves forward. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Elkins. Members, that's all the bills that we have for today. And I don't see anything else here. We're meeting tomorrow morning. We have 5 bills up, a couple changes, a couple were taken off, and one was added. Members, so we'll be meeting tomorrow morning at 8:30. And with that, see you all in the bright and early in the morning. We're adjourned.